I think that there's a way you can love God, love guns, and really hate greenhouse gases. I think that's a possible thing. And so hoping to change the party platform on that.
Today on the Politics Podcast, Congressman-elect Madison Cawthorn. Hey there, I'm Jeff Tiberi. When U.S. House Representative Mark Meadows announced earlier this year he would not run for re-election, it set off a flurry of candidate filings. Within weeks, Meadows, a firebrand conservative who helped launch the Freedom Caucus and later oust U.S. House Speaker John Boehner, was named White House Chief of Staff. And months later, when the campaign dust settled, a 25-year-old had advanced through a primary runoff, as well as a heated general, to earn election to Meadows' old seat on Capitol Hill. That's where Cawthorn, a Republican, spoke to me from last week. He's a staunch President Trump supporter and ultimately earned the president's endorsement. We talked the morning after President Trump gave that long, rambling speech about election fraud. And I asked the congressman-elect what he made of it. A quick note, you'll hear him mention Sidney Powell. That's one of the attorneys who's recently been advising Trump.
I'll tell you, I feel like it was not succinct enough. I don't feel like it was something that was it wasn't a great one-liner type speech. It was really just explaining what's going on and laying it out in very simple terms. But unfortunately, I believe President Trump needed to convince the majority of the electorate so that he can have a lot of defense and a lot of people coming to his aid if for whatever reason, the election results were to be overturned in the courts. And so we're all waiting to see what Sidney Powell is going to come out with.
Sure. Here you and I are. We're recording this conversation 1 month after the election day itself, December 3rd. You and I are chatting. I'm unaware of any evidence of widespread voter fraud, election fraud. Are you aware of any?
You know, aside from just briefings with the Trump legal team and their claims that they have evidence of widespread election fraud, I am not personally aware of any.
So at this point, we've heard from Republican elections officials and Republicans in various places. I'm thinking of Georgia and Michigan, federal judges who were appointed by Republican presidents in Pennsylvania, who have all basically debunked or shot down this approach, this effort from the president. We haven't seen any evidence, widespread evidence to this point. That, of course, that doesn't indicate that there isn't any, but we haven't seen any. There's been a month now. Do you think it's the responsible thing for the president to concede the election at this point?
Oh, absolutely not. Because at that point, people would not trust the election process. You know, I understand why Sidney Powell has not brought the evidence to bear if she does have some, because she is in a strategic battle. She's going into a court case, and the people who will be defending their claims of how the election went on as she's persecuting it or prosecuting it, she doesn't want them to know what her approach will be, what her tactic will be, so she can't release it yet. That's my understanding of why no evidence has been released yet. But I do not believe it's the responsible thing for President Trump to concede just yet. But I do believe whatever happens on December 14th, when all the elections are going to be called and certified, I'm going to trust that our court process and our election process worked and was verified and that our votes counted.
December 14th, the electors, just for hypothetical conversation's sake, the electors vote. They give Joe Biden the requisite 270 electors. Is it then time for President Trump to concede this 2020 election?
As far as I understand, that's the legal process. I mean, there's nothing that for the president's doing that's, you know, outside of the legal framework that our Constitution and our laws have set up. But once we come to the end of that legal process, you know, I'm going to trust the results.
Madison Cawthorn emerged from a field of 12 Republicans, this in North Carolina's 11th congressional district. The constituency includes all or parts of 17 counties in the western reaches of the state. At 25 years old, he's set to become the youngest member of Congress. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is 6 years older. We spoke as Cawthorn was on Capitol Hill for freshman orientation, recorded our conversation December the 3rd, and I asked him if he has experienced a holy crap or pinch yourself, welcome to Congress type of moment.
Man, you think I've just had one? Oh, it happens almost every single day. You know, I by no means am unaware of the magnitude of the ramifications of me getting elected. You know, I'm 25 years old. I am sitting here going to work inside the Capitol building, which is a beautiful monument that the Americans should all take pride in. And, you know, I'm sitting there on the House floor where I've seen so many things debated. I've watched so many State of the Union addresses. And I'm looking around, and I have access to that floor. I can go whenever I want. I have the highest level security clearance that you can possibly have in the country. I can, for practical reasons, if I want to know something before I vote on a bill, I can practically know almost anything in the country. And I'll tell you, that is an incredible responsibility. And I definitely feel the burden of responsibility on my shoulders. One, because I realize I'm representing over 700,000 people in Western North Carolina, and their needs are very real. I'm going to execute good legislation on their behalf. But also, I understand that I'm the very first person born in the 1990s to be in Congress. I'm the first Gen Z politician there is. I'm the first Gen Z Republican. And because of that, you know, there's a lot of eyes and scrutiny on me to really kind of set an example of what my generation represents and what we can do if given the chance.
How Madison Cawthorn is using that chance to represent both his generation and his political beliefs has rubbed some people the wrong way. Around the time I talked to him, I also spoke with Mo Davis, Cawthorn's Democratic opponent in the 2020 race. Now, Davis doesn't mince words when it comes to expressing his concerns about Cawthorn's ability to lead or make the best decisions for the state's 11th district. During much of our 20-minute conversation, he was critical of Cawthorn. At one point, I asked Davis if he had spoken to the congressman-elect since election night, or if he had called to concede on November 3rd.
I was going to call that night, just about the time that, you know, everybody called the election. My group, you know, that had been working with me was there, and, you know, I was going to talk to them and tell them the news and then make the phone call. And as I'm talking to them, somebody said, "Hey, did you see the tweet that he just posted?" And that was the one about cry more lib tears or something like that. So that's when I said, "Look, you know, I had no interest. I saw no benefit of calling after he'd posted that, I mean, I knew the guy was an asshole before, and that just pretty much confirmed it."
The tweet read, "Cry more lib." It was not directed at Davis. Perhaps to you, Mo Davis sounds like a sore loser. Cawthorn later himself conceded that the tweet was not the most congressional thing he's done. His campaign experienced its share of controversy here in 2020. Some statements Cawthorn stood by, and others, he says, were moments where he misspoke. And ultimately, I was left to wonder if one of those moments made it into my conversation with Cawthorn.
I'm off Capitol grounds right now, but I'm currently looking at the dome and the beautiful stars and bars flying above it.
Stars and Bars, a nickname for the Confederate flag, a symbol of white supremacy, one that does not fly above our nation's capital. As Madison Cawthorn takes in the view of the district, just how should we view this newly elected representative?
I cannot say, you know, in my life that I don't believe it's an ordained life. It's a life that God has definitely blessed. You know, just the fact of, you know, coming back from close to being dead during my car accident to now being elected here in Congress, I feel like so many doors have been opened for me. I feel like this is such a great opportunity, and I'm not going to waste it. I'm not going to waste my shot. I'm going to fight to save our country.
You were a staffer in the district office for Congressman Mark Meadows. Is that what gave you a push to run for Congress? I mean, we don't see very many candidates in their mid-20s. We don't see any other than you Congress members of Congress in their mid-20s. Why did you run for Congress?
One, you know, I did get to work as a staff assistant for Mark Meadows. So I really got to see the constituent service side up close and personal. And so I'm very passionate about that. I want to make sure that the people in my district are served better than anyone else. But also, the biggest push for me, you know, I just got engaged, about to get married on April 3rd to a beautiful young woman, Christina. Very excited about it. And, you know, we're actually getting married on the anniversary of my accident. And it was her idea, you know, to change the history of that day. So instead of it being sad, it'll actually be a happy memory, which I think is pretty incredible. But since we're getting married, you know, obviously we've had the talk about, you know, family planning. How many kids do you want to have? When do you want to have them? That kind of thing. And so afterwards, you know, I'm sitting out on my back patio with my dog, smoking a cigar. I'm thinking to myself, what would it be like to raise a kid in this culture? You see how divided our country is. You see many of our great cities burning. You see just the hatred that so many people have, the extremists on both sides of the aisle. That's something I want to fix before I bring another generation into this world. And so that's what really gave me the impetus and the genesis to really want to run for Congress and to get involved.
So you are set, as we've talked about here, to become the youngest member of Congress, the first member, first Gen Z, perhaps not the first millennial, but first person born in the 1990s. I'm curious, who are you surrounding yourself with or tapping into, experienced advisors or voices, as you get acclimated and likely continue to try to navigate the landscape of Washington here in your first 2 years?
So, you know, that's an excellent question. I believe that if you want to know the character of a man, look who he surrounds himself with. And I'm definitely taking a very careful step to make sure that I get a lot of mentors who have been here for, you know, several terms, people who are true conservatives, people that I believe in. And I've surrounded myself with several of those people. You know, Congressman Richard Hudson in North Carolina, he's great. Congressman Ted Budd, also out of North Carolina, is incredible. Congressman Mike Johnson. These are people I really look up to, and I've started to gain wisdom from and advice from. And but also on my staff side, you know, I'm working to get somebody who knows the legislative process very well, has a law degree, someone who can really execute good legislation on behalf of people of Western North Carolina. But I'm also importing a lot of staff from outside of Washington. And, you know, I'll have a few people who know the game and who know how to run this area, you know, as my chief of staff and as that moves forward. But I want to bring in a lot of true believers, not these career bureaucrats who are just kind of here to advance their own agenda or to advance themselves in Congress. I want people who see this as a duty. We're all here, you know, for a period of time. This is not going to be our career. We're going to come up. We're going to get term limits on Congress. We're going to work to balance our budget. We're going to make sure that the American people are less divided than when we got here, and then we'll be done.
How many should Congress members be limited to?
You know what? I know a lot of people who push for term limits. They want to say two or three. But in the end, you know, I think a realistic number would probably be six terms. You know, if you can't get something done in 12 years, I don't really think I want you representing me anyways. But that would really light a fire under a lot of these legislators who, you know, enjoy a 90% reelection rate since the 1900s. And because of that, you know, I think that they need to have an impetus and a catalyst to make them want to get something done before they go back to their districts so they can have a legacy.
So you have faced some allegations or claims of racism, of anti-Semitism, of sexual misconduct. You've defended yourself on all of those, as I've read and seen. And I'm wondering, moving forward, so, you know, somebody makes a claim, you defend yourself, you say, no, that's not accurate, no, it didn't happen. But now, as a member of Congress, I'm wondering what you're planning to do, if anything, in an effort to, I guess, further perhaps represent those communities and further represent that's not who you are, right? Some of these claims, some of the things that have been asserted about you. How do you build bridges? How do you make inroads with those communities that are part of your constituency?
Of course. Well, the first one, the claim about me being a Nazi sympathizer, I think is the most ridiculous thing in the world. You know, when I went to the Eagle's Nest in Germany, which is, you know, where the Band of Brothers, if you watch that HBO series, Easy Company really celebrated victory over the Nazis. And it's a very popular tourist destination. You know, over 100,000 people go every single year. But, you know, I wasn't going there because I wanted to, you know, revel where a man of pure evil used to exist and used to be. I was going there to be a man in a wheelchair, someone the Nazis would have put to death, to roll into this person's, you know, vacation home, their backup area if Berlin was ever to fall. I was rolling in there as a man in a wheelchair, someone they would have killed, speaking English, enjoying time with my brother, reveling in the fact that we defeated the Nazis and we claimed victory over that supreme evil. And that's why I was there. And so the fact that somebody wants to misconstrue that to say that I'm some kind of a Nazi sympathizer, I think is insane. And then, you know, but when it comes to the claims of anti-Semitism, you know, that one really upsets me. I have a lot of personal friends who are Jewish. And I genuinely believe the main way I can really make inroads with that community is, one, I'm working to get onto the Foreign Affairs Committee, mainly to stand up to China, but also to be a fervent ally and a fervent defender of Israel. And so I'm a Zionist Christian. So, you know, I believe in the Christian faith, but I also believe that the ancestral home and the right of all Jews in this world is to have a homeland in Israel. And I will defend that until the day I die. And I believe that's my Christian duty.
Other ways, if there are any others, how you mentioned the Foreign Affairs Committee. How else? And I do think some of this is perception, right? Like perception becomes reality. And then let's just acknowledge there are some people, and I'm acknowledging you disagree with them, right? Like they say, because of your rhetoric, you're a divisive figure in Congress. So the impetus, I think, fairly or unfairly, is back on you. How do you work to change that opinion? Or do you not necessarily see it as your responsibility to change that?
Well, one, I think that there is an arm of the liberal media out there who just doesn't want to see success out of Republicans. And so I know that I won't be able to change that fact, but I do believe that through my actions, anybody who's objectively looking at the situation, I can prove to them that I'm not this divisive figure. You know, I plan to reach across the aisle, find some Democrats who are situated in rural areas in their district, and work with them to create a bipartisan bill for rural access to the internet, to broadband connection. And I think that's something that would serve my district very well, but also it would serve these Democratic districts. And that's not so I can just get, the internet to Republicans. It's so I can give access to this free and open chain of information to everybody, no matter their race, creed, or religion.
I'm going to try to move through some things rather quickly. We'll call it rapid fire. I don't feel like we've got to go super rapid fire, but I want to try to move through some things. But let's follow up on something you just noted. So I'm curious, can you point me toward a couple of Democrats that you're thinking about trying to work with, or a couple of areas served by Democrats that you think would be ripe for that broadband bipartisanship?
You know what? I am. We actually just discussed that last evening, and so my team is currently working to identify those Democrats who are in rural areas who have the same needs as my district. But you know, I don't know their names off the top of my head. I will say that a lot of the Democrats in the freshman class, we've created a friendship and gotten to know one another. And so, you know, I don't think it's all has to be hateful rhetoric and saying the left is always wrong. You know, hopefully in the future we can find a way to label each other as Americans first rather than Republicans or Democrats. Well, brother, if you want to run rapid fire, let's you start shooting. I'll start firing back.
You get it. Two policy areas that you've talked about a lot in media interviews, broadband, which we've talked about here, and infrastructure. What's the first piece of legislation you plan to file next month?
First piece of legislation I plan to file is going to be broadband connectivity. I'll probably do it like the Rural Electrification Act that happened in the 1930s, but I'm still working through the details on that. Next piece of legislation, my long-term goal, and that's when I will probably decide that my time in Congress has come to an end, is getting term limits on Congress.
Top three committees that you would like to serve on?
Foreign Affairs, Oversight, and Appropriations.
Climate change, big issue. I think you are in perhaps the minority of Republicans and conservatives who have talked with some regularity about climate change. You said in a recent interview, quote, "I want to make sure that we are energy diverse. I don't want to get rid of fossil fuels, but I do see the wisdom in diversifying our energy portfolio," close quote. What is feasible on the environment front? What policy would you support? Give me one or two examples.
I'm going to make sure that we are very wise about the way we move forward. I think that we should really be investing a lot more money into research and development. That's the way we got fracking, which has greatly reduced our CO2 emissions when it comes to gaining fossil fuels. And then also, I really believe that we should focus on some renewable energy sources, continuing to increase the effectiveness of gaining energy from the sun through solar panels. You know, I think that's something that I think would be very effective and can work very well for the majority of America. But I think that there's a way you can love God, love guns, and really hate greenhouse gases. I think that's a possible thing. And so hoping to change the party platform on that.
One major takeaway, life lesson, reflection, steer it in any direction you want, but one notable thing you learned from this run to Congress and now being in Congress?
That people will do anything to get elected. I have found that, you can take somebody who is objectively not racist and the mainstream media is so powerful that they can paint that person to be whatever they want. Fortunately, the people of Western North Carolina and the majority of Americans have seen through this farce. They see that really this is just a normal tactic that the left uses. And, you know, now we are here on the precipice of me swearing into Congress. And I give my word to the people of Western North Carolina and all over the country that I'm going to fight to change Washington. I'm not going to let Washington change me.
I had a conversation with Colonel Mo Davis recently, and I asked him if he had spoken to you since election night or on election night. And he said that he had your number and he was preparing to call you on November 3rd. And then you sent out a tweet, that tweet that, of course, has gained some infamy. It read, "Cry more, Lib." That was the tweet. You have acknowledged since that that was not a very Congress-like tweet. And when I asked Davis about all this, he said, after that, I saw no benefit of calling after he posted that. I mean, I knew the guy was an asshole before, and that pretty much confirmed it. That's the quote. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction, you know, I believe that when it came to that tweet, of course, as I've said before, that probably wasn't the most congressional thing to do. And it wasn't directed at my opponent or anyone like that, but really it was directed at this cancel culture we see in the world right now. You know, as I was saying in the previous answer where I was talking about how they can take someone who's objectively not racist and paint them to be whatever they want. And I think that's the problem. And that's really kind of what I was referencing in that tweet, was just kind of these this cancel culture, these vultures who are out there who just try to ruin people's lives for their own gain. You know, fortunately, the American citizens and the rugged, individualistic, amazing people of Western North Carolina saw through that farce. But that was my intention with the tweet. You know, I don't really care if my opponent calls me or not. I'm here to work for the people. I don't care about my own ego.
Are you open, interested in having a conversation with him at any point, or are you there's no love lost between you two?
Yeah, no love lost. I mean, if there is a way I can better help my constituents by having a conversation with my former opponent, then absolutely, I have a conversation.
Congressman-elect Madison Cawthorn on Twitter at CAWTHORNFORNC, Cawthorn for NC. He's one of three new U.S. House representatives from North Carolina. Another, Democrat Kathy Manning, joined the podcast last week. The third, Deborah Ross, set to serve a Wake County district, is likely to join the pod in the weeks ahead. Let me ask you something. What has been your favorite podcast episode in recent memory, or your least favorite? Who or what would you like to hear on this podcast in the months ahead? Please share any ideas, requests, complaints. I'm on Twitter at J_TIBS. My email, JTIBERII@WUNC.org. Thanks as always for being part of the community, the listeners that keep public radio thriving. We'll chat again on Friday when Becky and Rob stop by for a review of the state political happenings. Until then, for Madison Cawthorn, I'm Jeff Tiberi.